Hello and welcome to today's episode in our How Do You Remote series, where we discuss all things related to remote work from guests representing a variety of fields. Joining me today is David Evans, who is a training specialist with the Department of Defense. In this role, he is an LMS administrator, content creator, data wrangler, also does consulting work with Urban Plates on the West Coast and serves as the learning and development manager. And if you asked him about his approach to remote work, people would call David a remote aficionado. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me. I'll kind of just start from 10 years ago, whenever this first started. So I was working up for Utah State University, and I was working with their distance education department. And at that time, our dean actually became vice provost and eventually vice president. So there was a huge push at the university level to really spread out amongst Utah to get that distance education out there. So I started tiptoeing into, I guess, what you would call remote work on site. So I was working distantly with various instructors, students, those sorts of things all over Utah, from, you know, way down in Moab at the Four Corners area where Navajo Blanding area is, all the way to the east where, you know, there's the Ouray Reservation towards Colorado. So we were really spread out all over the state to deliver distance education. And previously, it had all been delivered via snail mail. And so we were kind of behind the curve. You know, it was about 2013, 2014. And everything was still delivered, you know, with booklets, all correspondence. There was email and things like that, but there wasn't really a learning management system. There wasn't really much of a system to deliver education remotely to other remote folks. So again, this is kind of backwards. It's not me working remote with on-site folks like I am now. This was more, I was on-site. I'm figuring out how to deliver education, content, knowledge, wisdom, whatever you want to call it, all over Utah. We did a lot of what's called IVC, interactive video conferencing. So it was live lectures, but over video conferencing. So we would have to find sites where we could deliver that to. And students would kind of come into a classroom setting still, and they would watch these live lectures. And then it evolved from that into more of like blended learning, where lectures were pre-recorded. Everything was delivered online through Canvas, our learning management system. You know, we produced the media for the instruction that we needed to. We organized all the technology, the classroom technology that needed to be used to be able to deliver that content. And so it was a lot of, I guess, trial and error to see what really worked best. And it, honestly, a mix of everything worked best. We just had to get really targeted in how we delivered that content. So it was really interesting from that perspective, from the other side of things, being on site to delivering to remote folks and working with those remote folks, because we would do a lot of traveling too. We'd get into the fleet vehicles that our department had, and usually it's just like a little Prius or Camry or something like that. And we would drive 5 hours out to Blanding or Moab, or go out to places like Vernal, where there's oil fields and dinosaur bones and things like that. You know, there's not much else out there. So what I found really cool about that was that remote work took me traveling, and I didn't miss being with my family during that time quite a bit. You know, being able to go out and see the pride face-to-face and joy that these folks had as they're graduating. And normally those opportunities wouldn't be available to them unless, you know, they did the snail mail thing, or, you know, they had little community colleges and things like that, but these weren't full degree programs. And this is an agricultural college that I worked at. You know, they had business schools and other focuses and things like that, but Utah State University is an ag college. It's a land-grant university. So it was really used and useful for rural areas. And so it was really interesting and really fulfilling to go to the graduations of folks like in the Navajo Nation, where they would come tranced, you know, regalia and things like that, and they would come celebrate. And we would have these graduations out there that were in like these little high school gyms. It's just overflowing with people who are so grateful to have that education delivered to them and to be able to take advantage of those same opportunities. That's where I really started getting my feet wet and my hands dirty with remote learning. And then it really has just stepped up from there. And so from there, I got hired at University of California in Irvine, where you and I met, and where I worked with you full remote. And it was sort of the same. You know, we worked on site. I had an office. We had conference rooms. I was still able to see people. But all the instructors that we worked with, all the students that we worked with, they were all offsite. So we weren't dealing with any in-classroom instruction anymore. We were having to figure out how to work with all these subject matter experts who mostly were not used to being instructors. One thing that was really interesting with that, and a lot of things that I learned in working with subject matter experts, instructors who were fully remote, is trying to adjust to not having those physical social cues, especially when most of them, you know, a majority of them weren't using cameras on their computer, you know, it was mostly just talking over the phone. You know, people just don't turn on their cameras. People just don't want to be seen. It's hard to work with people like that when you're used to working with them and taking cues, those social cues from their body language, you know, from their facial expressions, those sorts of things, to all of a sudden, okay, I'm trying to gauge what this inflection in your voice means, trying to gauge maybe what this silence means.
I think that's a really important point about the social cues and communication. What would you use, what you saw on video, what would you do with those cues? How would you use that to compensate or change the conversation? Or what would you do with that?
Yeah.
When you could see them.
So when you could see them, and if like you put out an idea and somebody just kind of gives you that look, you know, like, are you serious? Sometimes you get that, you know, that you can, you can work around that. You can work with that. Okay. Maybe they don't like that idea. But sometimes remotely, especially if you don't see their face, maybe they're just silent because they're thinking about it and they agree with you. Maybe they're silent because they just want to get off the phone. Whatever it is, you know, you don't want to seem unprepared or not confident and guess what maybe they're feeling. Maybe, you know, you don't want to assume what they're thinking. But when you're face-to-face, you can pull those cues. You can see my smile. You can see me gesturing with my hands and those sorts of things. So you can kind of gauge the engagement that we have with this conversation. Not being able to see the person, only being able to hear their voice, it's so much harder to be able to gauge their engagement. And another thing I dealt with, and I'm sure you have too, is when you're working with multiple instructors who disagree with each other, and you're kind of the mediator, and all of a sudden you're the mediator in whatever drama that they're coming up with, because maybe they have a disagreement in how they're going to deliver the course, how difficult the course should be, those sorts of things. So now all of a sudden you're having to be a mediator, and you're not seeing any of those social cues. All you're hearing is, you know, the discontent in people's voices and those sorts of things. It makes it difficult getting social context of situations and trying to guide those situations to make them have the best outcome. I think it takes a lot more getting to know the person that you're working with whenever you're working remotely, especially if you don't see them. So after working, you know, at UCI, I moved down to the University of California in San Diego, and I started working remotely with federal agencies and creating programs from UCSD and working with these federal agencies who also had a lot of high standards that we had to meet, but working remotely. And a lot of that was typically through email and things like that.
So you don't even get to interpret tone. You have to interpret the tone of an email, which is the hardest thing ever.
Exactly. And wow. We all know how dangerous it is to assume. Yeah. It's like, you know, you get a text message from somebody and sometimes you think, well, what do they mean by this? And you don't, again, you don't want to assume that, you don't want to assume the meaning, because oftentimes there won't be, you know, those connotations of anger or whatever it is when it looks like it. So there's a lot of clarification. There's a lot of smiley faces entered into the email, exclamation points, you know, those sorts of things where it's almost like, and I have to lower the professionalism standards, I guess, that you would have, so that you could kind of build up those personal relationships.
To humanize it, for those things that's missing, the elements of the nonverbals and the cues that are missing. Right. Okay.
That's exactly it. So I try to, you know, the big thank yous and I appreciate your time and all those things to kind of make it so that you're not, it's not sterile and it's not, you know, it doesn't come across the wrong way. Especially when you need something from somebody and you want to be, you know, brief and to the point. Some folks take that different ways and they might assume how you are coming across. So it's important to be clear in your communication in those instances when you're working remotely with email or text messages to be clear, not just in your message, but how you feel.
In any of these situations, have you ever preempted the email so that they could interpret it correctly? Have you ever done that?
Certainly have done that before. You want, hey, this is coming across, or even pre-warning them if a coworker is going to send them an email. Certainly have done that where, hey, somebody new is coming into the conversation here. You know, everybody has different personalities. Some people very much more want, you know, I want to hear what everybody has to say. Let's all work as a team to figure this out. And then you've got the folks who are very much just, tell me what you need to tell me, get it off your chest and move on. I don't want the fluff with it. So again, you know, with the written communication when working remotely, some people like that fluff. You know, let's get to know each other a little bit. You know, sometimes you get the questions, how was your weekend? So you go with it. And other people, they don't want any of that. They're so busy, or they have that type of personality where they just want to hear the facts and they want to hear what you're going to do about it and move on.
Based on your observations of the communication styles and between the face-to-face with video camera versus voice versus email, so those different channels, what do you think the standards of communication are going to look like, say, in the next year or two with remote as a factor? The human element, we can't lose that. We have to have that in some way, or maybe we have different new types of ways to classify communication styles so we understand, hey, that's a, like you said, a no-nonsense. Or like we have those in the past from the face-to-face work environments, but what is that going to look like in the future? So speak to any of that inspires you.
Yeah, absolutely. Things are changing and technology is permeating throughout our entire lives, period. You know, and whether it's elementary age or adults, we're all starting to have to figure this out, especially after COVID when it was turbocharged to how, you know, we're working remotely with each other. The speed at which companies are accepting remote work as the norm, the speed at which we're having to adopt technology to be able to work remotely. So we're starting to figure out those communication differences on a wider scale. And I think more and more people are kind of starting to figure that out a little bit. Currently, I work with folks who none of them get on a camera. So we have all of our meetings. I put my avatar picture up there so you can at least see my, you know, a smiling headshot.
Oh, they don't even have the avatar. They don't have a picture or anything.
Yeah, they don't even have that. So I don't even know what some of my coworkers look like.
Wow.
So, you know, not that you need to know what coworkers look like, but I think that's just kind of become the accepted norm. Whereas previously, a lot of folks, you know, you go in a meeting and say, hey, do you mind turning on your cameras, please? Or you get that pre-warning, hey, we have a meeting coming up. Be expected to be on camera. I don't get that much anymore, especially in the line of work I am. And we're spread out throughout the entire country, in different time zones, me and the teammates that I work with now. But, you know, we get into the meetings a little bit early and we kind of spend some of that time to getting to know each other. You know, how was your weekend? What did you do? Getting to know each other a little bit. And then once the time comes for the meeting, then it's all down to business. So you still kind of have to carve out a little bit of that time, even if you don't see each other, to kind of get to know each other, especially if you're on an ongoing team working with each other. Spend some of that time, you know, figuring out the ticks and quirks of some of your team members, the things that they like, figure out how you can connect with them. Because now you can't smile with them. Obviously, you can't do all those sorts of things that you do face-to-face or even on camera. So now, you know, you're getting to know the people. You're putting forth a little bit of effort, a little bit more effort, I think, getting to know your teammates on that personal level and building those personal connections. Not that you have to, you know, be buddy-buddy and fly out and see each other and those sorts of things, but it's always important to kind of build those connections. It is superficial as it may be, but still on a personal level. And I'm very guarded with my family. I'm not one of those people that, even when I was in my office, I didn't hang up pictures of my family and things like that. And it's not because I'm a curmudgeon or don't like my family. I just kind of keep my personal life and professional life a little bit separate. But there's still those, I guess, kind of superficial things that you can still talk about and build those connections. And then once you're done with that, then you adjust to, okay, what are the professional, what are our milestones? What have we done? What are we working on? What are the issues that we're encountering? And then you keep it simple. And then that way, you know, you're not stuck on the phone for 2 hours with, you know, a bunch of unnecessary fluff in your meeting. And that can happen, honestly, so much in face-to-face meetings where you get off topic. I know you've been in those meetings. I have too, where it's just like an hour into the meeting, you feel like you haven't really talked about much because you're going in circles or getting so sidetracked.
So you just want to disconnect, mute your mic, and just work, do your work. Yeah.
Yeah. Which exactly.
Is, yeah. Yep. Okay.
Or get on your phone or whatever it is. So, you know, those communication styles, at least on my team, we've compartmentalized them, but we've also made it so that there's time for both without making it so that we're not wasting people's time. So we spend time connecting with each other sort of before the call, and that's all voluntary. You know, we don't, there's no peer pressure to join in on those conversations. That's all happened organically. So we all jump on 10 minutes early, not everybody, but you know, we all kind of catch up with each other and spend that fluff time and get it out of the way. And then once it comes time to the actual meeting and everybody's joined, then get to the point.
That's really a great strategy. You mentioned something about connecting with people and the different safe topics and various things that you don't want to share too much, but you want to share enough that there is that rapport that you build. Tell me about topics you have found to be a really good type of way to connect with people.
Oh man, there's some easy ones out there like ice cream. Everybody, well, most people love ice cream. So, you know, just as icebreakers, there's always those icebreaker questions that you can come up with. You know, what's your favorite type of ice cream? One thing that I have that I use to connect with people often is I've lived all over the country and I've lived all over the world. So you're from Alabama, right?
We connected over that. I remember because I was the only one not in California at that time. And yeah, you had said,
I lived in Georgia and that, you know, that's not Alabama, but that's the South.
Still in the South. Yeah.
So culturally I understand how you are and where you're from. And we could talk about, oh, the humidity is the worst or the cicadas, it's May. So it's probably right there in between the cool and getting hot times. So, you know, connecting with people based on their region, if you've traveled there before or you want to know more about it, kind of those prodding questions.
Have you found people are responsive when you prod them about their region or something that they...
Oh, for people, as a rule, people love to talk about themselves.
That's a universal truth, yes.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, it's not disingenuous when I'm asking people. I come across as I really want to know, because I do. You know, I worked with at UCI as somebody who was from India, and you know, I don't know anything about India. I've never been there. I know the geography a little bit. I know where it's at. You know, the basic stuff about India, but it's a huge country full of different cultures. Cities are different.
This is India.
India, yeah.
India, okay.
Yeah. So you know, just hey, where are you from? In India, and they'll say, and of course, I don't know where they're talking about. You know, maybe I'll pull it up and look at it after the conversation or whatever, but oh, tell me what it's like. What is, you know, what do you miss about India? Cause they're here in the States. You know, what are some of the things that you, what are some of the similarities? And, you know, you can go, there's a million different questions you can go off of that and build kind of that subsurface, rapport with them. But you know, also you could just keep it simple. One of the people that I went with, or that I work with, he went camping over the weekend in the Smoky Mountains. And same thing, it's like, oh man, I lived over that direction. I never got a chance to get up there. I would love to get out there. And they start talking about the mountains. They're not even talking about themselves. They're just talking about what the mountains look like. And so those are the types of things you can do to kind of build some of that rapport. And you don't even have to be on those topics for very long. It's just showing interest in who they are and what they do. And usually that's reciprocated. You know, we're very, humans in general are very gregarious creatures. I try to live like this. And I try to teach my kids to live like this, is how you approach people is typically how they're going to respond. If you approach somebody, you know, sort of angry, you know, whoever it is, it could be the checkout person at the grocery store, and there's an issue resolved. If you approach them angry, they're going to get defensive. But if you approach them nicely, open, you know, they're probably going to be a little bit more collaborative. And same thing with the people that we work with. The first time that we're working with people, we come across friendly and confident and interested in them and genuine, they'll respond with that. Not always. You know, there's always exceptions to that rule. And that's kind of one of the benefits, I think, of working face-to-face and in person, is you can iron out those situations a lot easier than when you're in person. Because I don't know what the equivalent is now. It certainly is a little bit more prevalent. But, you know, you got those people in traffic, or you got those people on a telephone who act differently than they would face-to-face. And I used to call them telephone tough guys, or the traffic tough guys that, if they were standing next to you, would not be acting the way that they are if they weren't hidden behind, in, you know, in their car, behind the telephone. I think that comes out a little bit more work, yeah, where you have to deal with people who maybe act a little bit differently than they would face to face, and maybe they're a little bit more confrontational because there's that virtual distance, or that physical distance, that safety, you know, where they don't have to worry about any repercussions or anything.
You talked about working with people in different time zones. How do you overcome that?
Now that I'm with the Department of Defense, we have people that are global. So they could be in Italy, they can be in, you know, Africa, Korea, Japan, all over the place. My team is all on the East Coast and I'm on the West Coast. So there's a 3-hour time difference there. So I'm getting emails at 5 o'clock in the morning already. And I know you've dealt with this being where you're at and having to work with folks in California. You know, that time difference, you got to set those boundaries and expectations, and they've got to respect those boundaries and expectations. Now, that's not to say that you can't be flexible, because you have to, you know, but they've got to know that I'm not answering emails at 6 o'clock in the morning. So if they need something, they're going to have to wait until 7 o'clock my time, which is 10 o'clock their time. And they've already been working for a couple of hours, so they're getting antsy, you know, waiting on responses and those sorts of things. The team that I work on now, they're very good at knowing that I'm not around.
And that when you do get on, it's going to be a response. So
that
trust level to say, hey, I got it. Once you send it to me, I will respond to it.
That's a really good point, is, you know, building up that trust level and that their confidence in you, that is going to be addressed. You know, one of the benefits of having people that are kind of working globally or across the United States is you've got all those times covered. We've got people working in Hawaii, and it's easier for me to work with those folks because my time zone's closer. I think that's like a 3-hour difference or 2 hours, something like that, versus like a 6-hour difference where with the folks on the East Coast. We cover more of the gamut because we are working globally. So that actually benefits us to have folks working remotely in all these different time zones. But there have been meetings where I've had to attend. It's literally 6 o'clock in the morning. And these are large, you know, all hands on deck type.
So just periodic schedule, not like, you know, impromptu meetings. We know about them.
Exactly. Yeah. But I'm setting my alarm so
that I can, get up. Now, do you work an early day on those days and get off earlier?
Okay. I just adjust my time.
And, that's good. The flexibility. That's good.
You know, one pitfall and something that's a little bit dangerous about working remotely, for me anyways, is I will work more. You know, some of those days where I do wake up early and get going, and I'm an early bird, I might still work till 5 o'clock, just because I'll get going and going. You get on a roll. There's no, hey, I need to beat traffic, so I should, I need to be done and get going now, or I need to get home for dinner, so I should probably get going now. You know, those sorts of the cues and things. It's so easy to get caught up in your work when you're working remotely, especially from your own house.
Because we find that our work is purposeful and we have that buy-in. Do you think remote lends itself more to that motivation to be productive and to really want to do a great job and really immerse ourselves in the work more than going into the building because we don't have all those extra times devoted to commute, to getting ready, to all of those things?
Commuting certainly, it takes a toll. It burns you out. I've had those jobs where I commuted 1 hour and 20 minutes one way through snow, through canyons, you know, and it really takes a toll on you where sitting in traffic is not healthy for you mentally. You know, it drains you. Physically, it's not good for you. So having to do all of that on top of working, it certainly drains you throughout the day. And then I'm the type of person where when I'm in an office, I don't take a lot of breaks. You know, I won't stand up very often. I won't go walk around. I might go grab something to eat, but I'll probably just eat at my desk. Maybe I'll go eat out with some coworkers, but that's the extent of my getting up and giving myself a break. So by the end of those 8 hours in the office, some days my brain is just fried. And then you have the commute on top of that afterwards. And so you get home and sometimes it's 6:30 at night and getting ready to go to bed at 9 o'clock, which I'm an early bird, so I go to bed early. And all of a sudden your day is gone and you start over again, and then your day is gone and then you start over again. And you kind of lose a lot of productivity just because of the toll that commuting and not taking those breaks and not being, I guess, responsible in the office with the way that you take your breaks. It really takes a toll on you day after day, week after week, month after month. Really burns you out. And so I know this from personal experience, affects your productivity. But being at home, I wake up, I take my dog out, get a little bit of exercise. I'll come back and check emails just to kind of get my head in the game of what's going to go on that day. Maybe what issues have bubbled up in the morning that I wasn't aware of. And I'll go make coffee. Then I'll come back to my computer and respond to the stuff that I can respond to right away. And then I'll go stand up. I'll go make myself some breakfast real quick. This morning I had an egg sandwich. You know, and I don't do that at the office. I don't take, you know, I might bring a cup of soup or something I can microwave, or, you know, because I don't like to spend money on going out to eat, especially every single day. There's no way. I might bring a salad or something like that. It's a good way to lose weight, I guess. But, you know, I'm not taking those breaks to take care of my body like I should. But at home, you have those opportunities, or remotely, you know, you have those opportunities. Sometimes I'll go sit outside and work. Sometimes, you know, I'll go and for my lunchtime, I'll go take a 20-minute nap on the couch. And I'm so refreshed after that. Everything, you know, I'm not groggy. I don't take long naps or anything like that. So,
but in the office, that would just not even be an option.
There's no way. Yeah, there's no way. So come 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, and my coworkers knew this, I would not be productive in a meeting because my brain is just, it's wired where it's not really, it's tapped out after the entire day. Where working remotely, I can keep refreshing myself in different ways, whether it's taking the dog out, whether it's making coffee, or you know, going out for a walk just by myself to go get some fresh air real quick. And those are all certainly things you could do in the office. But it's so easy just to get stuck in the rut when you're in an office setting around other people of having meetings all day long. Or not getting up from your desk because you're just in the zone, staring at a computer for 8 hours a day. Whatever it is, there's so many more opportunities when you're working remotely at home to refresh and rejuvenate yourself. The way that we work is, as long as you're getting your work done and you're responsive, you're in the meetings you're supposed to be in, you know, you're not being micromanaged. I don't want to work like that. I don't, you know, not many people work very well being micromanaged, at least in our industry, I can imagine. I know that there's companies out there who are certainly trying to track the time at every minute of what, you know, people are doing and their productivity. That's not helpful. Again, you're not treating somebody like an adult. People like to have that respect, even just from a privacy standpoint. People are always going to find a way around these technologies. People are always going to figure out a way to kind of skirt the system, whatever system that is. I understand where these businesses are coming from, especially in the private sector where time is money. You know, they want to make sure that whatever they're investing in their human resources, their employees, they're getting a good investment out of, and they're getting productivity out of. I get that. But most people that are doing work from home they're able to work from home because they're using these systems that you can already kind of track the time on the anyways. In my experience, you know, any business or the companies I work for, they have access to my emails, so they can see when I'm sending emails and things like that. When I'm in a learning management system and I'm making changes, there is time stamped. So there are ways to still track productivity from a quantitative standpoint, I guess, without invading the privacy and time of a worker. For me, being micromanaged, especially at the level that we're at, it seems counterproductive because, again, there's ways around it, but two, it seems like I'm not treated with respect. I'm not trusted. I'm just, you know, another cog in the wheel. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. I wouldn't want to work for a place like that, especially from the experiences I've had at places that do that.
That's what remote's about, because if you have that person that's remote, how much more will their motivation be to do the right thing because you expect that of them? You have those clear expectations.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. If you put that trust in people to do the right thing and they're constantly doing it and you're acknowledging that they're doing the right thing, suddenly I trust the business that I work for more. If they trust me, it goes both ways. I trust them. You're going to be dedicated to that company. You're not going to be inclined to leave, because from a leadership standpoint, because I've hired folks that work remotely for me, you certainly have to set those expectations of producing quality materials. I know there's distractions, because I know from experience, but I know there's distractions, you know, from cell phones to Facebook to YouTube to whatever it is, the television that you've got on because, you know, maybe you want to watch Office Space in the background, whatever it is. There's going to be a myriad of distractions. So setting those expectations is certainly important from a leadership and institution standpoint to make sure that you are getting that productivity, because it does go both ways. You know, you can't just be an aloof remote worker. You got to build that trust and make it so that they can be confident in you. And I like to do that as quick as possible, just because I don't want anybody to question me or, you know, question my abilities, question the quality, question how I'm spending my time, any of that kind of stuff. Setting those expectations, like, look, I'm giving you this time to do it, and I'm giving you the space to do it, and I'm giving you the trust to do it. You've got to do it. And if you don't, then I'm going to have those conversations with my superiors on finding a new employee, somebody that I can't trust.
What's some words of advice that you would like to pass on?
Use this time, take advantage of it when you're working remote to find that work-life balance. Because we've talked a lot about, you know, the commuting, the office time, the office space. We've spent a lot of time talking about, you know, the good and the bad of working remote. But, you know, my advice is certainly to find that work-life balance or take advantage of that work-life balance. And I'll give you an example of what I do. You know, I have kids, so I'm able to take advantage of either being able to go pick them up from school, drop them off at school, go to sporting events, things like that, that normally I would have missed being in an office setting. But at the same time, you know, not overworking yourself at home. It's so easy to do, especially if you're ambitious, especially if you got a lot of extra work to do, especially if you think that the work that you're doing is just going to be quick. There's always going to be work to do. So use your time wisely when you're working remotely. Be smart, not just about the work that you submit and the work that you do for the company that you work for, but be smart about your own life. That's certainly something I'm trying to work at, you know, fitting exercise in, fitting time with family in. Now that I've got more time, less commuting and things like that, is just to strike that balance.
That is a great note to end on. I'd like to thank you again, David, for joining us today. And thank you to our listeners for tuning into workforceremote.org's podcast, where our goal is to help you to continue to go remote and work on.